morning, everybody. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're all too well aware before we went off this weekend, the shooting that took place in Philadelphia, where a man claiming to have shot a white police officer, a black man saying that I did this on behalf of Islam, in the name of Islam. And it raises a lot of issues. And it raises a lot of issues about what it means in many ways to be Muslim in America, what it means to be black and Muslim in America, what it means in terms of our society's responses to Islam. You've seen the Republican primary. You've seen it raised in other places around this country right now. It's only intensifying. And so we want to talk about that and about what that says to us as a people. And what our responses should be. And so we have a really interesting panel here with us today. Charles Ellison joins us one more time, as we'll be doing a great deal, public strategist and host of the Ellison Report here on WEAA. Imam Derek Amin is with us. He's a Muslim chaplain here at Morgan State University. Zainab Chowdhury is with us. She is the Maryland Outreach Manager for the Council on American-Islamic Relations. And Tariq Torrey, writer, poet, and activist, will be with us shortly. So good to have you all with us.
Good to be here.
Good to be here.
And good to have you back with us, Zainab, one more time. And please join us for your comments and questions here at 410-319-8888. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Comment on the Mark Steiner Facebook page. Send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. But do call in, 410-319-8888. Want to hear your ideas here on the airwaves, 410-319-8888. So I'm curious, and Imam Derek, I mean, great to have you here on the air. So when that took place last week, when the officer was shot, I'd like to feel and hear from you your kind of your visceral and kind of intellectual response to that when you heard it happen.
Wonderful, thank you very much. I guess my visceral reaction was that this was a very disturbed young man, irrespective of whatever religion he proclaims. Islam or no other religion has a monopoly on mental illness. I think that this was a very emotional reaction to a situation where he is pretty much bereft of ideas. He doesn't have the ideas to change his own condition, and so he lashes out. And I think that culturally, the term Islam and Muslims in the Philadelphia area, anyway, is one that is used a lot by African Americans in the Philadelphia area. So that's my visceral reaction. My intellectual reaction is to say that this conversation is almost always isometric. It is one where very few people are informed about what Islamic doctrine really is, and so when you enter into a conversation about religion, as it is, most of our conversations are not balanced from the standpoint of the person who is non-Muslim. They are not familiar with Islam. They usually are not familiar with the doctrines of the Quran. Like, it's impossible to say that somebody does something in the name of Islam. That's not the way Muslims talk anyway. We might do something in the name of God, or we might do something in the name of Allah. But to say that I'm doing something in the name of Islam is not our God. It's simply our religion. It would be the same as somebody saying I'm doing this in the name of electricity, you know, whatever the medium that comes to mind in that young man's mind and in many others. It's not, you know. I think that young people are in a place today. I'm talking about people who are under 40, are in a place today where there's so much information and so much of a flux in terms of information and knowledge that they really don't know how to handle it all. And if you're a deprived person to begin with, you grow up under deprivation and poverty and grow up in the concrete jungle, as they used to say. You're usually very desperate to justify your existence through something, and religion becomes convenient in many of these cases. I think that's where I would start.
Mm-hmm. And Sam, your reaction, someone who's in the middle of this world between the America and Islam.
Right. Yeah, I had two sort of raw emotional. Oh, I'm sorry.
I was going to Zainab, but go ahead.
Oh, go ahead with Zainab first. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Sure. So viscerally, I would say that, of course, you know, like anybody for the most part who heard this news and experienced a sense of disgust and horror that, you know, anybody could, you know, shoot an officer or anyone else like this. That's really what I experienced. And, you know, it's become the norm for many Muslims here in the West that whenever an incident like this takes place, our first reaction is, you know, dear God, don't let it be a Muslim. It shouldn't be that way, but unfortunately that's, you know, the kind of the first or second thought that comes to our mind. But intellectually, I would say that, you know, if we religion and who understand the tenets of the faith of Islam would know that these kinds of actions cannot be committed in the name of Islam. Unfortunately, you know, recently with the advent of terrorist organizations who have committed terrible acts and who've done it under the banner of the religion have given Islam a bad name, and it's become more easy to scapegoat the religion, especially for lone wolves. Now, we know that this is an ongoing investigation and that we don't have all the facts. We know that the suspected appear to be mentally ill, which is another angle that I know the authorities are considering, that perhaps, you know, he wasn't necessarily affiliated with any terrorist organization or he wasn't necessarily radicalized, but he may have acted out of some, you know, mental disturbance. But we don't have all the facts right now, and this is definitely a situation that my organization is monitoring.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I had both sort of a mix of the emotional and also the intellectual reaction, or sort of the policy-oriented reaction to what happened in Philadelphia. I mean, the emotional reaction was first as a person who grew up in Philadelphia, as a native Philadelphian, and sort of being very worried and concerned about friends and family back home, you know, hoping that this wasn't indicative of something that was going to be much larger, that something was afoot that would go beyond just that one isolated shooting of that Philadelphia police officer. And I have a few friends who are also on the Philadelphia police force, and I immediately texted a couple of them just to kind of check in with them and say, hey, how are you guys doing? What's going on? What's happening? So that was one. That was that first emotional reaction. But in terms of the intellectual reaction, I've been concerned with respect to specifically Philadelphia, also with concerned about what's happening, trends in other communities as well, but especially kind of looking at Philadelphia specifically, or even other major urban cores like a Baltimore or Chicago or elsewhere, where you have a lot of rampant extreme poverty. So Philadelphia having the imam alluded to this, Philadelphia has arguably the highest urban extreme poverty rate in the country. And so, you know, I've always been worried and very concerned, especially since recession hit, about this convergence of extreme poverty, of unemployment and underemployment. You know, we see these unemployment numbers decreasing in these monthly Bureau of Labor Statistics reports, but that's the official unemployment rate. But it really doesn't show that there's actually greater unemployment for a lot of folks who've fallen off the grid from long-term unemployment and also underemployment. You know, we don't factor that in. And in a city like Philadelphia, that's very rampant, particularly for black men. So I started thinking about, you know, how not only is this man a Muslim, but he's also a black man in very black West Philadelphia and in a city that's about 50% black. And so in Philadelphia, we've grown up with the reality. Islam is very, very close and personal for Philadelphians. I mean, it's a very, you know, we sort of look at it as sort of an essential ingredient or component of Philadelphia's socio, cultural mm-hmm. and political life. It plays a very significant role. And so I think you're probably looking at a very interesting, very unique response from Philadelphia officials, from the Philadelphia Police Department to the shooting that'll be somewhat unique and somewhat different from how other police departments would respond. Because, you know, even whites in Philly understand that, you know, there are a lot of African-Americans in Philadelphia who hold Islam, you know, very near and dear. Even if you're not a practicing Muslim, you have family members. I have family members who are either, you know, practicing Muslims or who are kind of like, you know, who just embrace it and like to say, oh, you know, I like Islam and I want to learn more about it. So that all kind of in terms of that intellectual reaction, I thought about that. And I do have this worry about the convergence of poverty, economic conditions, and also religion and what role that plays in it.
So, I mean, I'm going to parse some of the stuff out we just said here, and also welcome Tariq Touré to the program. Good to have you with us, Tariq, again. And please do join us at 410-319-8888. But let me push this from the other side for a moment. I mean, there are a great many Americans, if not a majority, who do not trust Muslims or the world of Islam. Mm-hmm. And when these attacks take place, like took place in Philly, whether the man was mentally deranged or not, for the mindset of America, it doesn't make any difference whether the man was deranged or not, or whether the man who was deranged who shut up the military office in Tennessee was deranged or not, or what happened on the Army post just a few years ago with an American soldier who was a Muslim as well. And so those things, given the tenor of the presidential race, compound those feelings. So that to me is a response. Let's take it there before we go back to what we just said here. I mean, we're in that place in America now. And so my first visceral reaction was, just to put it out there, when I heard this was, oh, my God, because this is a black man who was also a Muslim who shot this police officer on the street wearing the flowing robes, and that's what America sees, you know. And so and that it was akin to the reaction that one of my best friends had the day that Kennedy was assassinated, I remember, and he went running down the hall. His name was Jeff Outlaw. From an old black family in Oklahoma. And Jeff said, I could just hear it in his voice going, thank God he wasn't black. Thank God he wasn't black, the man who killed Kennedy. That was what he was saying on that day. So, I mean, so that's very real, right, mm-hmm. in what we're facing. So, Zainab, let me just start with Zainab for a moment because you work in that every day. So your thoughts.
Right. And Mark, that's exactly the reason why whenever we hear incidents like this, there is an automatic kind of, you know, inclination for many Muslims to recoil and just, you know, it's almost a double-edged sword. Like while we're grieving and while we're upset and while we're processing the event that's happened, at the same time, we're bracing for backlash. Because like you said, Muslims don't have that luxury of being given that, you know, that same kind of leeway in terms of, oh, he might be mentally ill or that he might have, you know, some other problems or some other issues, or it might be workplace violence or what have you. If the identity of the perpetrator or the suspect is determined to be Muslim or even suspected to be Muslim, the way the story takes off is completely different. And it's not just how it's portrayed in the media or how there's bias in how the investigation unfolds, but it's also how the general public responds. And unfortunately, that's a very real concern. That's something that, you know, we have seen manifest as hate crimes and bias attacks and a significant, unprecedented level of Islamophobia that we're witnessing now in the United States, where we've had over some 80-some mosques that were targeted threatened for in attacks last year in 2015 alone, which is the largest number that we've ever seen of mosques being targeted. And that's how that fear and that anxiety towards Islam and Muslims translates as. It translates in part as more hate crimes and bias attacks and bigotry and discrimination and harassment that unfortunately creates or perpetuates that cycle of, you know, fear and anxiety within the Muslim community. And, of course, we've had, you know, sane-minded people, rational people who have stepped forward, who have stood in solidarity with the Muslim community to reject this notion that perpetrators who commit these crimes and claim to commit them in the act of, in the name of Islam or under the banner of religion are not reflecting the ideals of religion, and the entire community across the nation or globally should not be painted with the same brush. But there's always that segment of the population that cannot or won't differentiate between, or they won't accept the fact that within every faith group, there are bad apples who are going to do things that unfortunately will reflect badly on the entire faith. Or they can also have mental illness that unfortunately, you know, manifests as these kind of incidents, which are extremely tragic and need to be condemned and need to be, you know, rejected categorically. But also, we have to make sure that the rest of the Muslim community doesn't suffer the brunt of the backlash from these incidents.
Did you all jump in?
I would like to introduce Tariq. I want to avoid being placed in a position where I become an apologist for Islam or Muslims. I'm not qualified to do that, first of all, and I don't want to offer legitimacy to whatever it is that this young man was motivating this young man. However, I think that this particular young man offers us more than one narrative in terms of his motivations. The African American narrative is there. He proclaims to be Muslim, so that brings up the Islamic narrative, and the poverty and deprivation of Philadelphia as it relates to African-American people is another narrative that is being portrayed in the actions of this particular young man. Americans tend to politicize just about everything, politics has never offered a panacea. It doesn't even really offer a cure. It's simply as Americans we tend to rely on it a whole lot more than we really than we really should. I think that the answer to many of these questions can be found by digging deep into the moral and cultural philosophies of the American people, and there are no easy answers, right? And I think that we need to separate out all three of these narratives, which occur in this one person, right? We need to separate them out, find out really what the deal is. I think it's very, very unfortunate that when people like this get arrested, for instance, we don't hear the conversation that goes on between them and the police authorities, right? We don't really hear what goes on in depth as it relates to what we get on the news. What are the police saying to this young man, and what is he saying back to them? You know, let's explore what's really motivating this young man. And it's obvious that it's not religion. It is something having to do with his condition within the society. I just want us to to kind of go more into that direction, because I don't want to be apologetic about Islam, as any Christian on here would not want to be apologetic about Christianity or Judaism, you know. And I refuse to get into that position. I don't need to apologize for Islam, and I don't act that way. I don't go out and shoot cops or bomb buildings or do any of that. It's not part of who I am.
Tariq, let me let you jump in.
I want to chime in. I completely agree with that point, that we have to be careful to not, especially the Muslim community has to be careful to not be seen as apologists who are automatically accepting responsibility for these actions. And we shouldn't feel like we have to. There's just that there is this expectation for Muslims to do so, but unfortunately it creates, you know, heightened levels of anxiety and fear. But I absolutely agree that we should be careful to not be placed in that position where we feel like we have to apologize for actions that we don't believe in, we don't condone, and our religion doesn't condone either.
Well, first, I want to say I'm happy to finally get here to be sitting and drinking from this well of wisdom. From my standpoint, I can only look at the backlash, and I realize that in America, and just like any other country, xenophobia works. You know, it sells, it bleeds, it leads. So this is a very opportune time for people who want to sell that narrative to go ahead and put this story on full blast. We know that every day in the city of Philadelphia and many other places across the country, there are Muslims living in complete harmony on soccer teams, basketball teams, checking you out at the grocery store, all types of things. They're coaches, they're financial advisors, they're lawyers, they're all these different types of people. So the best thing that we can do within the Muslim community is continue to go about our day-to-day lives and helping people in the way that we're helping people. Because the people who have interpersonal relationships with us, they know for a fact that all Muslims are not about this. Far before the brother even shot that cop, far before that, he was already on the path to do something. He just chose Islam as his microphone for whatever he wanted to do. So for people like that, we just want to make sure that we have some type of preventative care to see, you know, can we get to them early? Was he somebody in the mosque that, you know, people should have talked to, different things like that. So for me, it makes me think about the relationships that we have in our community. And this is everybody's community, whether it's Dylan Roof. Was somebody talking to Dylan, you know, before he decided to do that? Was somebody talking to the guy who did the Planned Parenthood thing? Was he, were they having these conversations? So it's really, for me, about community. In a community, you know exactly what's going, not exactly, but you have an idea, you know, of the temperature of certain people and the temperament of certain people and what they're capable of doing. This is a certain obliviousness that I see with regards to the brother. Like, you know, nobody knew he was on that. So all of us across America have to start building more in our neighborhoods and stuff like that. So we, you know, have those relationships.
So we're going to give a brief break. And Charles, you can come right back in as soon as we take this break. Stay with us here. Don't go away. We want to hear your thoughts. We haven't heard from you yet. Call in 410-319-8888. And your thoughts on all of this. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're here with Charles Ellison, Imam Derek Amin, Zainab Chowdhury, and Tariq Torre, and you at 410-319-8888 as we explore what happened in Philly, but in the larger social context here of what it means for the world we live in here in America, the American response to it, but then also to explore a bit before we end this hour what it means in America to be both black and Muslim and how this responds to all that as well. You were going to say what, Charles?
Yeah, and sort of expounding on that question and that conversation, because you notice there's sort of like a tension here. There's a tension between being black and being Muslim. And so, you know, we had a conversation before the break about how you didn't want to be apologist for the actions of one Muslim. You didn't want to apologize for the religion. But then, you know, then it also creates a paradox there, because you don't want to be apologist, particularly as we're sitting here. You know, you've got two black men here who are also Muslims. You don't want to be apologized for the actions of a black man, because, you know, there's that extra added tension there, too. It's interesting, you know, sort of the national conversation has centered more on this individual being Muslim than the fact that he was a black man in West Philadelphia. And it seems as though, you know, the national conversation, it doesn't want to go there. You know, the CNN headlines, the highlights don't want to go there, particularly, you know, because you did have this other brother who did shoot and kill, actually, these two police officers up in Brooklyn, New York, not so long ago. And there's been this constant tension and struggle. It's been especially pronounced over the past couple of years between local or big city police departments and also African-American communities. And so there's some of that. I mean, it is West Philadelphia. It is Philadelphia. And there's always been tension. I'm just telling you, as someone who grew up in Philadelphia, I mean, that was all part of it. Part of growing up in Philly was that tension, that constant tension, that tug of war between, you know, us and the police. I mean, it's just like that was one of the things you grew up like as a kid. I remember before leaving the house, you know, don't cross the police, the cops. Yeah. I mean, that's what we saw in the 1985 bombing of MOVE. And there's always been this tension between the Philadelphia Police Department and certain social, political, and religious elements in the city, whether it's MOVE, whether it's black Muslims, whether it's black Israelites, whether, you know, you got all these different groups, all these different with all sorts of political or religious or economic agendas. And I mean, sometimes they're knuckling up. You know, they're actually, you know, getting into to armed fights with Philadelphia Police. And Philadelphia Police, they know this. They're used to it now. And so but I find that interesting, you know, that tension between being black and being Muslim.
The very dynamic of becoming a Muslim in America as a black person is what I think we need to look at. African Americans have always tried to express our humanity, mm-hmm, in ways that have become grating or unorthodox to the average white person, you see. And Islam is no exception. Most of us have become Muslim to express express our lives differently from the way that we've been told to express them, right? So, mm-hmm, so it's an act of rebellion in some cases for us to convert to a religion, an unorthodox religion. It's jazz, if you will. You know, it's Miles Davis. Miles used to say, "If I had a religion, it would be Islam." You know, so it's that added way of expressing a cultural reality. I'm different from white America, you know, and I don't really accept to look at the world in through the eyes of the one who of those who I see as an oppressor. That's not my view. Yeah. I'm just saying that is a phenomenon that goes into the decision to become whatever it is that we want to become. That crossroads comes to almost every African American person or black person,
you know,
in America.
Real quick point, so, not to cut you off. Real quick point. And there's sort of an ancestral signal there too, because a lot of people don't realize in this discussion we're having about Muslims in America, 30% of black slaves were Muslim. There's a 30% chance that you have Muslim ancestors if you, you know.
There's a memory.
There's absolutely
a memory there. And Eric Lincoln brought that up.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's really important. I was thinking about the conversations that I've had. I'm going to go to the phones here that I've had over the years with W.D. Muhammad when he was still with us. And he graced my show many times. And I learned a lot from him in the process of those conversations. And I had this conversation. I would just throw this out to you all. And I had this conversation this morning with the great poet Ethelbert Miller. He started writing me this stuff last night, and I wrote him back this morning. And one of the things I wrote to him back was this. And I read it earlier to Imam Derek Amin when he came in, and he wrote about being Islam in America. And I said about how great it was. He wrote the depth of it. I won't go into all that too. And I know that you're also a great poet, Tariq, so you might appreciate some of this. I think some of the depth of history of what it means to be black and Muslim in America, fully one-third, if not more, of the enslaved Africans dragged to these shores were Muslims. Many of the great slave rebellions were led by enslaved African Muslims, and the majority and a plurality of American Muslims are African-American, what does Muslim mean? Secular, NOI, Salafist, Muslim, mosque, Ahmadiyya, none of the above, all the above? Can the A-train give you Allah and Ellington, or just Jesus and Ellington? Or do we just need Ellington? If we get the pork, what a non get rid of the pork. If we get the pork, what a non-Muslims give up along the way? I fear the voices in the hearts that take their holy works as the true words of God smite the rest. Two trains running. How do I know which one to get on? So I mean, I wrote that to him this morning because I was just kind of wrestling with what this show means today, and what it means in the power and complexity of being black and Muslim in this culture that we live in.
In a word, get on the Muslim train. what I would say about that is very shortly, I would just say I think that Muslims have an obligation to tell people to come in. You know, there always seems to be this visceral reaction to say, you know, to kind of close up. I'm saying come in, irrespective of whatever it is that your religion is. Come into our house, find out what it is that we really are saying, really are thinking. Read the Quran, come visit a mosque, and get to know what it is that what the real deal really is. Get on the train. You can always go back home.
Tariq, I'm going to jump in. I want to get to the phones here.
So I think number one, you know, education is big. So. If you've been here in America for over 20 years and you haven't covered, you know, the souls of black folk and, you know, listened to W.E.B. Du Bois talk about double consciousness in black people, and then also this added triple consciousness, you're black Muslim and you got to remind yourself that you're black and Muslim in America. So, like, those, you know, those dichotomies kind of collide every time you walk out the door now because of this Islamophobic stance that, you know, the larger society has taken. I think also, you know, speaking of what Brother Amin was saying, plurality. So Tariq Ramadan has a book called Lessons from the Life of the Prophet. And in it, 90% of the narrative is how Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, is taking the time to work with people of different faiths and creeds and different things like that. So if we really look into his history, it's all about being in harmony with people who have different views. I had to quote Mos Def now. Mos Def said recently, you know, in a phone interview, he said, it is not how people, you know, agree that makes humanity, you know, succinct and in harmony. It's how they disagree. So I think, you know, from now on, we had to start changing the story to seeing, you know, how can we start to disagree without bloodshed, without xenophobia, without, you know, all this massacres and different things like that.
Let me open the phones here, and then we'll go right back to Zane, and we can go back to Charles at 410-319-8888. And Rashid, you're on the air.
Thank you, sir. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
What I'd like to say to our brothers in this process, what we don't do our research, because I got in front of me now the Treaties of Peace and Friendship dealing with 1797 and 1787. In those treaties, the United States of America signed off on those treaties. So if we understand and go back to the law and study the law of why we're here in America under the Islamic banner, we have to go back to those treaties, which the brother is not discussing, because there's no such thing as a black Muslim. This is the first thing we have to understand. You can't be black and a Muslim. You have to have a nationality. So under our nationality, we go under those treaties of Morocco and peace and friendship of the Tripoli and the founding fathers, Charles Barkley, Francis Scott Key, all these people signed off on those treaties dealing with this part of the country. So we have to understand the treaties and the law with those treaties provide for us as being here in America long before the Europeans come here. We're not studying our Islamic religion properly based on the law.
All right.
So I'm saying to us, I am not a black Muslim. I'm not a black Muslim. I'm a Muslim in America, but I'm not black. So when you put yourself under that black status, you take yourself out of those treaties.
All right, Rashid, thanks so much for your call. Let's go over to Leo, 410-319-8888. Leo, welcome.
Yes, good morning, Mark Steiner.
Good morning, Leo Burrows.
Good morning to you and all your guests. And all I can say to you, brothers, stand your ground. You're saying the right thing for the right reasons, and I commend you, Mark, for having this discussion. I'm a Black Baptist, and I've got many friends who are in the Nation of Islam. And the Nation of Islam is partly the reason why the setup is being perpetrated at this time, this attempt to bring down the Nation of Islam in this country and other blacks. Stand your ground. America is fundamentally an institutionalized racist society, and Donald Trump is doing its bidding, and not only from the point of view of the Republicans, but he's doing it for white men in the Democratic Party as well. So let us not forget that this is a conscious effort to bring about the final solution. We are being held at this point in concentration camps. There's an effort to generate concentration camps in this country, i.e., Baltimore City, Paul Graziano, public housing, and we can go on and on. This is a conscious effort, Mark, I do believe, to exterminate black folks in this country. And let me close on this note. What about these white racist terrorists in Oregon who are allowed to seize federal land and the land of the Native Americans and nothing happens? That's why I'm saying what I'm saying. If we are not vigilant, if we do not physically defend and protect our right to exist, we will cease to exist. Something must be done, and we must remain vigilant.
Leo, always good to hear your voice. Thank you so much. Let me go to Charles and Zainab. We haven't heard you for
months. Real quick, talking about what your previous caller, Rashid. I made a very good point. I defer to him on the details of that treaty, but you made a very good point in the sense that, you know, a lot of folks are under the impression in their history classes that our first foreign or diplomatic relationship with another country was with France. It actually was with Morocco. Morocco, the Kingdom of Morocco, was a Muslim nation, was the first country to have diplomatic relations or diplomatic ties with a very young United States. So Rashid is very much right. As far as the details of that treaty, I don't know.
Yeah,
I can't do that. But it's and then kind of going to what your last caller said real quick. It's just a very interesting conversation that we're having right now, particularly in American political discourse with the 2016 election. You've got Republican presidential candidates who are talking about Muslims barring Muslims out, but, you know, being very ignorant of the fact that you have Muslims that are native born here in the United States. You have a huge, large African-American Muslim population. Ben Carson, of all people, should know that, growing up in Detroit, which is where the Nation of Islam was founded. And, you know, it just being a black man and also being here in Baltimore as well, and sort of just being very ignorant of that and being ignorant of the political and cultural diversity and economic diversity that's within the Muslim diaspora here in the United States and elsewhere, we're having that discussion. But also, your caller made another good point about, you know, and I had a colleague when that shooting happened last week where he was like, oh, my gosh. I hope now this is not one more thing to give police an excuse to target black people or black men. And that is a worry.
No, that's a huge worry. And I think that's a big piece of what we're worried about here. And I think we can debate the history. I mean, I would argue that from my reading of history, that the first country we had diplomatic relations with was France. That was right after we declared. And then came one of the first countries after that was actually what's now known as Algeria, which is where the treaties took place. We can argue that one out.
and it's been an ongoing relationship. Even to this day, we have a very close military relationship with the Kingdom of Morocco. A lot of people don't know it, quiet as it's kept. Very, very close. We actually just sold 100 M1 Abrams tanks to Morocco. The United States did. Very, very close relationship.
Before we went, Zainab, you want to have a thought on what we just said and come back to the question of what this could mean, what we're not seeing under and the top of the news about what the results of this shooting could mean for the black community and the Muslim community in America. But Zainab, go ahead.
Yeah, Mark. I've been following this conversation, and it's very fascinating, just listening to the different opinions and the thoughts of the callers and your other panelists. I think that this is a conversation that's very timely and very critical, especially as one of the callers mentioned that we do have a situation going on in Oregon where we have a militia group who's, who's staked out at a federal grounds, and you know the way that the media is responding to this situation, the way that the federal agencies are responding to the situation, is extremely, you know, there's a strong disparity with how the situation is being handled, because they're a white militia group versus if they had been, you know, black or if they'd been Muslim. One thing I want to point out about Islam is that it's not a monolith. And, you know, recently I was listening to a conversation about, well, who speaks for the world's 1.5 billion Muslims? And I think it's important to point out that, you know, we're going to have as many different opinions as there are people, because everybody has their own perspective. They have their own unique experiences that they bring to the table that help shape their perception of the world around them, of themselves, of their different ideologies and what have you. And to expect that, you know, everybody is going to have, you know, they're going to be on the same level about, you know, every critical issue just because they share the same religion, it's going to be a big mistake, because it's just not going to happen. People have different perspectives. They have different ideas. And I think the same goes for the black experience. I'm not black myself, but I grew up in a black community. And many of my childhood friends, some of my first Muslim friends were black. And so just my experience from having been able to, you know, have insight, glean insight from their experiences and listen to them and their stories firsthand. I mean, I think, you know, people have their own ideas of how we should address these issues. And I think that that's a very healthy discussion, and it's a critical discussion. We also have to keep in mind that long-term and short-term, the impact that these kind of incidents have on the psyche of Muslims, regardless of their race, it's pretty it's substantial in the sense that now we have Muslim youth from the black community and from other ethnic communities who are coming forward and saying that they're not comfortable identifying as Muslim, because now there is this idea or this notion that Islam promotes violence or Islam condones violence, and children are being bullied in schools. So we have, you know, this crisis within our communities as a consequence or as a result of this heightened level of Islamophobia that's being pushed forward by anti-Muslim rhetoric by, like, elected officials and GOP candidates, Donald Trump, Dr. Carson, that's helping feed into that fire, or it's like fueling that fire of bigotry and intolerance in America. And the question we have to ask ourselves is that who we are? And that's not who we, I don't believe that that's who we are. I think history shows that, you know, the people who fan the flames of intolerance are on the wrong side of history, and they're the ones who, in the long run especially, are going to have to pay the price. But right now, we just have to figure out how to set the record straight and make sure that, you know, there is as little collateral damage as possible.
Before we turn back to our guests, let me just get a quick phone call in here. We'll come back to both Tariq and to Imam Derek Amin. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Robert on line three.
Oh, hello.
Hi, Robert.
Okay. I have a question then.
Go ahead.
What interests me, I'm sorry, I'm a very secular brother, although I'm a predominantly Christian family, a few Muslim relatives, but I'm really a very secular person, really. What concerns me are such matters as social justice, economic justice, the fight against racism and exploitation. And so my interest in is the question of what our Muslim brothers and sisters think is the contribution that Islam, as they see it, can make to these battles for social justice. There's a brother named Cornel West, who is well known, who mentions in his book called Democracy Matters that there's a prophetic tradition, which is which originated in ancient Hebrews, but is also part of both Christianity and Islam, and that is a tradition which leans toward the fight for justice for the oppressed. What, in your opinion, do you think your religion has to offer to that?
Let me turn to Derek Amin, and then we'll go over to Tariq Touré.
Okay. I think I'm going to get a little bit personal.
Okay.
if you don't mind. I'm a veteran. I grew up in a Christian home. My mother and father were civil servants. My father worked for the MTA. I retired from the MTA, and my mother retired from Social Security. I became a Muslim in 1972. I was actually in the United States Air Force. My history is not much different from most Americans, irrespective of race or ethnicity. I decided to become a Muslim. It was a very conscious decision upon being exposed to the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I evolved from those teachings after a stint in the Middle East. I learned to speak Arabic. I learned to read Arabic. I learned to I learned more about the Sunni Islamic tradition. It is the way that I worship God. That's it, pure and simple. It's the way that I worship the Creator. That is what Islam is. That is what a Muslim is. It means to submit to the will of God. That's all it is. Now, there are other cultural, political, philosophical issues involved in all of the people of the world. There are many religions, many ways of answering the call of the Creator, and that's basically what we're doing. I follow Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, or peace be upon him. Now, that I am not different in some ways. The thing that makes me different maybe is Islam. So, in America, you can go to the library, you can find out what Muslims believe, you can read the Holy Quran, you can become Muslim, or you don't have to become Muslim. You can be secular in America, as the brother was saying. I do not think that it's fair, for instance, to say, what are the Muslims going to do about this or that? I'm Derek Amin. I vote in the elections. I've always voted. There's nothing different about my life than maybe the brother who was calling here. You know, not that much different anyway, except for the fact that I worship God differently from the way that he may or may not.
Well, powerfully said, Tariq Touré.
I think Brother Robert and the rest of everybody else that's listening, one of the excerpts from Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, his last sermon that he gave. He said, all mankind is from Adam and Eve, and an Arab has no superiority over a non-Arab, nor a non-Arab has any superiority over an Arab. Also, a white has no superiority over a black, nor a black has any superiority over a white, except by piety and good action. And I think the action part is what you were speaking about, Brother Robert. So Imam Amin is a little bit older than me. I won't date him myself as a—
Just a little
just
bit.
Just a little bit. Just a little bit.
We're going to go outside and race afterwards to see how's everything working. But what I'll say is as a 27-year-old black Muslim living in America, growing up in West Baltimore, now on the route I've taken in my life since I was 19 years old, I've been mentoring. I've been working with ex-offenders. I'm also a poet. I also write about these issues. I'm also someone who goes down front line and helps out with people who are doing protests, civil disobedience, things of that nature. I'm also a social welfare policy student at Howard University. So I'm doing all of that while I am Muslim. So the agency and the action to which you're speaking is exactly what Muslims are engaging in. I met a brother, an Egyptian brother, named Mustafa from Ferguson. And he's down there in Ferguson right now, you know, helping with legal aid. He's a lawyer with kids that are on the ground, the high school kids that are getting locked up down there, that are still getting tear gas to this day while we're speaking. So Muslims are very, 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 very embedded in this narrative of social justice here in America. We just don't have to scream out that I'm Muslim. If you see me right now, I got a hat on. You know, you might look at my beard and say, hey, he might be Muslim. But we would hope that—
Might just be a man with a beard.
Exactly. I just might be a guy with a beard, you know.
And I just might be an old man with a beard.
Right, with a couple gray hairs. So, you know, what are Muslims doing? I think that before anybody asks that question, you have to put a magnifying glass to the movement and start asking people questions, because there are plenty of people from all faiths, all different type of persuasions and creeds that are, you know, well invested and trying to bring some type of justice in this era. And, you know, I will hope that, you know, when you get this information, that you find ways to support the online links that they have for money. You find ways to support. You might even want to just bring a banner down that says no justice, no peace down there. But there are people, there are Muslims, tons, brother.
I wish we had another half an hour on this particular episode. Right. We only have like 3 minutes left. So let me let you kind of help us wrap up. And the Kadri and the other callers, sorry we didn't get to all your calls, but you all just came flooding in at the end here. And we only have a few minutes left. But let me at least get a couple of quick closing up from Charles and go
yeah.
to Zainab.
And, you know, the Muslims, you know, particularly black Muslims, African-American Muslims, have been very involved in the American social political fabric for quite a long time. You know, that's why it's so bizarre when especially Republican candidates have this conversation about Muslims in the United States, and they just completely forget about that. They completely forget about, I mean, you know, folks who grew up with Muhammad Ali or Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and others, you know, even Malcolm X. You know, it's just this long, or even going back even farther than that to the 1700s, 1800s. So, you know, there's this rich history. And also Muslims are very politically active in a lot of key battleground states, like Virginia, for example. I mean, the last Virginia governor's race was actually Muslims, very politically active Muslims, sort of decided that race on the margins, or states right. like Michigan and elsewhere.
More Muslims per capita in Virginia than any other state in the Union.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Correct. So, you know, people need to kind of realize that there's, you know, you do start kind of seeing in some of the rhetoric in this presidential race from certain candidates, like even Ted Cruz on the Republican. You know, there's a very politically active Muslim contingent in Texas. So you notice he's a bit careful in terms of how strong he comes out talking about, you know, all this about radical Islam. Yeah, but if you notice, if you really carefully listen to what he's saying, he's a little bit careful when some of these events happen.
So we really have about a minute and a half here, and I don't want to, we can't go over time. Is Zainab, a closing thought from you? Zainab, you still there?
Yes, I'm sorry, Mark. What was that?
I have about a minute and a half left. Just want to get a closing thought from you.
You know, I think that this is a conversation that, like somebody said, one of your guests said earlier, like we can't encapsulate in a one-hour-long discussion. But suffice it to say that whenever a tragedy like this takes place, when, you know, anybody is shot and the faith of the perpetrator is scapegoated for the actions of the individual, I believe that it bears reflection on our values as a society where people, the general public, seem so quick to generalize and want to throw an entire faith community under the bus for the actions of one individual. We don't see any other faith community that's scapegoated that way or that is expected to condemn or apologize the actions of any individual who engages in any action, whether or not they leverage their religion as the motivating factor or not. And I think that that's something that we need to be careful of as a society, to not do that and to treat each individual as an autonomous.
I'm sorry, we're just smack out of time. We're at the very top of the clock here, so I apologize after you interrupt. But Zainab Chowdhury, always great to have you with us. She is the Maryland Outreach Manager for the Council on American Islamic Relations. Tarek Touré. Thank you so much, Zainab. Tarek Touré is a writer, poet, and activist in our community. Imam Derek Amin is a Muslim Muslim chaplain here at Morgan State University.
Thank you, yes.
And Charles Ellison, political strategist and host of the Ellison Report here in WEA on Sunday nights, will remain with us for the next half an hour for our conversation on the black and brown caucus conversation that took place in Iowa with three Democratic candidates. Stay with us for that. We'll be back right after this break.